do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast, coming to you from Sydney, where today it is an absolute scorcher. My family and I are currently moving, which means the recording studio has been packed down, and I am currently sat underneath a blanket here to try and ensure some kind of audio quality in this introduction. So as you can imagine, I am absolutely sizzling. While on the topic of hot subjects, let's talk about purpose. We all want it, but what if we are approaching our pursuit for meaning from the wrong starting line? There is no denying that starting with why can definitely be helpful in a directional sense and in relation to shaping a business strategy. But it could also be said that starting with why is actually no different from setting a goal. When we are searching for purpose, we are looking for something much deeper, something that drives our behavior, that truly motivates us, and informs our habits from the inside out, and something that helps us to connect to a sense of fulfillment. And that starts with understanding not why we do something, but in taking a deep dive into who we are at the core of our personalities, our DNA of purpose. And in understanding purpose as who we are, we are also able to better understand those we lead in order to be able to mobilize change or ignite progress. And so, today, we have two incredible guests on the podcast who have spent the last few decades decoding how we humans connect to meaning, what drives our behavior, and what it takes for us to become more self-aware so that we can thrive by accepting all of who we are, while at the same time consciously evolving to reach new levels of mastery in our lives and also as executives and leaders. Dan Gregory and Kieran Flanagan are the Behavior Report, which was founded to help smart people be smart by sharing cutting-edge research on behavioral trends and strategy. Dan and Kieran have been maestros of the world of advertising for the last few decades. However, in this iteration, they are dedicating themselves to helping leaders, teams, and organizations to read and lead human behavior. And today, they have joined us to decode what it really means to unlock your full potential and to really step into the world by embracing all of who you are. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Dan Gregory and Kieran Flanagan, welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. It is such a pleasure to have both of you beaming into the studio today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The Behavior Report. I can't wait to dive in and learn a little more about your individual stories, but also the shared narrative of the Behavior Report and the work that you are doing together in the world today. However, before diving in, I want to kick off with a question that I have been asking all of my guests on the podcast, and this is one that I would invite both of you to answer, and it is simply this. What question are you currently asking yourself that is guiding your life or your work forwards at this particular point in time?
Well, that's actually quite easy for me to answer, and it's contribution. It's contribution. The question that's running me is, right now, I'm very conscious of my, short time on this earth, as most of us have, And, you know, the short time of work, you know, maybe another 20, 30 years of work left, what contribution, what's the thing I can create, share that will have the biggest contribution I can possibly have?
Amazing.
I think mine would be, similar. Although I think one of the things that, you know, the question that's sort of rattling around in my mind at the moment is very much around how do I help liberate people from their limits? And I think that's kind of, it's kind of been a recurring theme that Kieran and I have talked about over the past year. Like a lot of the work we do in personality psychology is sort of around liberating people from limits. But even some of the, you know, the one-on-one mentoring and consulting we've been doing with people who are sort of, you know, either they've gotten out of a toxic career or they're in the process of getting out of a toxic career. And some of those conversations have been about, okay, well, what would life without limits look like to you? You know, because I think one of the things that, you know, Kieran started by saying, you know, we've got another 20 or 30 years, touch wood, left working together. What do we want that to look like? And I think, you know, we've both had a number of things happen to us personally that has sort of woken us up. You know, I almost died in 2020 and spent a week in the ICU. And I think when I came out, Kieran and I had a conversation about, well, what are we going to do for the next 20 years? Let's make sure it's the stuff that matters. And so I think for me, it's very much, that's the question that's, you know, the question is sort of more outward looking than I think it's been in the past. And so for me, it's about how do I liberate people from their limits?
Dan, can I ask you, what have you found with regards to what keeps people locked in that limited thinking?
Well, I think it's very much to do with identity. Mm. You know, we have a limited identity, or, you know, and some of it's nature, some of it's nurture. You know, we learn that, oh, I'm particularly good at these things. You know, just before we started, Bex, we were talking about the fact that, you know, you're not musical, but your husband Ash is musical. And I grew up in a very musical family. Mm. And I'm a big believer in that, the idea that, you know, you don't really have a talent, you have a passion. And talent tends to follow passion, typically. And, you know, I remember when I was, my mum was a child prodigy. She won the National Estepa when she was 12 years old. And so in my family, everyone learned, you know, piano before we started school, and then, you know, I learned guitar. And people would say to me, you know, by the time I was in sixth grade, oh, you're so lucky you inherited your mum's talent. You're so lucky. You know, and I'd be like, well, that bitch gets me out of bed at 5 a.m. every morning and makes me do an hour's piano. Like, I earned this. And I think it's one of the, you know, Kieran's little girl is my goddaughter, and I bought her a guitar when she was 4. Not that she plays it, but I just wanted to have her to have music around her in her environment, because I think those environmental factors influence our identity, and they can either be liberating or they can be quite confining as well.
Mm. So, guys, I would love to gain a better understanding of the background context of your business, the Behaviour Report. Now, you both have a history of working together, Dan, as you've already shared with us today, for over 20 years as the co-founders of the Impossible Institute and also speaking together on stage. However, the Behaviour Report represents an evolution of your journey and one that is maybe becoming more integrated than ever before. So I'm really curious to learn more about what the Behaviour Report is all about.
Well, we are obsessed with human beings. You know, if you trace, you know, we always say people have a thread throughout their career, and sometimes you can't see it going forwards, but you can always see it going backwards. And for us, we started off in advertising. We had our own advertising agency, and we've always being just eat, sleep, drink, what drives people and what makes people do the things we do and think the things we think. And the Behaviour Report is an evolution of that. It's how do we bring this knowledge, and instead of using it to make people buy stuff, use it to make people understand themselves better, so they can relate to the world better, and as Dan said, so they can liberate themselves, so they can free themselves from limits, so they can do more of what they want, they can get a better result. They can laugh at themselves. They can understand themselves. They can build better relationships, better workplaces, better communities. And maybe that comes with age, where you really want to apply the knowledge for good and usefulness, where, you know, you're young and we just wanted to make money and make a name for ourselves. And I think maybe it comes with time and space that you want to help people with the knowledge so they can use it. So that's the behavior report. It's an obsession about human beings and them understanding themselves.
Yeah, it comes back to your lead question, which is, how can I contribute? How can I use what I know to make a difference?
Exactly.
And I think what Kieran said about, you know, looking for those life's threads, those threads that run all the way through your life that don't always make sense going forward but make sense in retrospect. So if I think about the, you know, we both studied communication at university. We both, I've very much lent into studying psychology since leaving university, and doing courses in psychology. And I think the advertising was always about human behavior. You know, the stand-up comedy was about human behavior and observation. And I think, you know, a lot of the work that we do with people is helping them identify that thread that runs through their lives that they maybe haven't, you know, discerned before, or it's, you know, it's always been there, but they can't see it. I always think that life makes a lot more sense in retrospect than it does going forward.
It reminds me very much of the Steve Jobs quote: "You can't connect the dots looking forward; you can only connect them looking backwards." So, essentially, he then goes on that you have to trust your gut, your intuition, and you know, I guess in some ways, the way he framed it was follow the path of destiny. I'm curious to know, though, Dan, what have you guys learnt about purpose in this work? Because when you're talking about this thread, essentially, what we're talking about here is in some part, reconnecting with the depths of who we are, that we don't need to look for purpose outside of ourselves. We simply need to connect with this thread that you're referring to.
Do you know, it's funny. Kieran and I went and saw Russell Kane two nights ago, the stand-up comedian. And the routine he did at the end, he said, basically he was saying, in every relationship, you need two people who are very different. You need one that's super organized and anal and is always on time. And then you need the chaotic one, you know, and you actually feed off each other. And I think one of the things, I mean, you said 20 years, it's actually over 30 years with Kieran and I have been working together. So I'll let Kieran let you know if that's a good thing or not. but I think one of the things that we've identified that makes us work is the fact that we are so different. We're both very different personality-wise. But Kieran's observation is, you've probably heard the metaphor of you know, the jar where you put the rock in, then you put stones, then you put pebbles, then you put sand, then you put water, right? And Kieran's observation is that for both of us, we're very different. All of the pebbles are different, all of the sand is different, all of the water is different. But the big rock that we have, that we both have, is the same. And I think that is sort of a really good metaphor for purpose, and in terms of what makes Kieran and I work together, is our vision and our purpose, both professionally and personally, is really aligned. And I think that's why it's worked for over 30 years. You know, there's just this this absolute sense of trust that has developed. And I think it's really, because if you think about most relationships, period, don't last, but most business relationships don't last particularly. And I think one of the things that's interesting about business is one of those things that does test your values, that does test your vision, that does test your purpose. And if you don't have that alignment around common purpose, I think that's when things start to become undone.
And no doubt so important when you're working together as a duo, which you guys have for so many years.
There's also a lot of pressure around purpose, so for people. Like, I think purpose has become this thing, like, I should have this deep knowing, and like, you see people get really stressed around purpose. And I think for us, purpose is, and part of the work we do is, if we can liberate people from their limits, if we can choose joyfully and say, I don't have to be fixed into a certain corner of identity, that I can learn other ways of being, I can develop other skills, I can lean into my weaknesses and not try to hide them, then they get more choice around purpose, not, oh, I'm caring, therefore I should, my purpose should be to take care of sick people. We have a very limited bandwidth for purpose. And for us, it's, why don't you open up to what would you really want to bring to this organization? What do you want to bring as a leader to your team? What do you have that's unique to you, but not from a scarcity, from that you have all of this in you? Because otherwise I think purpose becomes one of those words that it's like corporate vomit. And
absolutely.
And we don't, you know, it's, I don't know if everyone knows their purpose in that sense. And I think it shifts and changes.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, a lot of the work that I have done is around uncovering some of those myths. And there's so many ideas around, like, we can only have one purpose. Well, I can tell you, as both a mother and a professional, as two examples, well, they're two very different purposes that are both extremely valid in my life. You know, and I do think we get very siloed in our approach to purpose. Kieran, while we're on this subject, it's actually a nice segue to my next question. In doing some research and watching quite a few of your keynotes, you had referenced at one point Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Now, this is a model that has been used to capture purpose 1,000 times, and it's kind of this idea that if we can, you know, reach certain levels of need based on, you know, survival, having a roof over our head, all of that sort of stuff, eventually we reach this thing called self-actualization. And a lot of thought leaders over the years have aligned self-actualization to the notion of having a purpose. What I found really interesting in watching one of your presentations is you spoke about the idea that we never actually reach this point of self-actualization due to the fact that we have a part of our brain known as the amygdala, which is essentially hardwired for survival, which in the modern world basically means we tend to focus on the relentless pursuit for more success, more stuff, more bright, sparkly objects, as opposed to reaching self-actualization. So I want to dive into this with you further because you know, because it is spoken about as being the gateway to purpose. So I'm wondering if you can share your ideas on this, and how do we find purpose if we can't get past the evolutionary hangovers that prevent us from experiencing it?
Big question, because it's true, and I always joke on stage that we said, you know, we were going to go up the pyramid and towards the light, and most people renovated the bottom of the pyramid, built a garage to house all the stuff that we've gone out and built. And we can see it in our supersized lives, our supersized mortgages, our supersized cars, our supersized stuff. And so it's very tricky because we're wired by survival to want stuff. It makes us feel safe. We feel successful, we get to run around and have other people think, look at me, look at my stuff. So, and look, I think that, you know, like with everything, there's a movement both ways. But for Dan and I, and our philosophy's always been, maybe advertising taught us this, is don't worry about who people are, work with it. So you can still have purpose and a lot of stuff. I think Maslow, A, discredited his own model, but B, maybe it's not a pyramid. Maybe it's a flat line. Maybe you can have both. Maybe the stuff doesn't negate the need to contribute. Maybe the stuff sits alongside finding the purpose on one of the shelves. Maybe we just have to be more accepting of who humanity is and harness it. So our first book was called Selfish, Scared and Stupid. And it was all around this acceptance of human nature, that people are fundamentally, they act out of selfishness, not generosity. Like even when we give to charity, we do it because it makes us feel good. That people act out of fear more than courage. And that stupid was people look for the easiest, simplest way to get things done. It's human nature. It's why we have a remote control. We could get up and turn the TV. But, you know, we always say like laziness is the mother of all invention. not ingenuity or necessity. It's definitely not those things. So I think you can have both. And again, this judgment around one's more worthy than the other, the pursuit of purpose is more worthy than the pursuit of stuff. We put so much judgment on things versus why not say who you are is perfect and it's okay. Let's just harness it and apply it for really useful outcomes.
Mm. So, Dan, if we focus on who we are and start with who, as opposed to starting with why, how can that better inform the transformation that we'd like to create in our life?
I think that's a really interesting question. And to be honest, it's the subject that Kieran and I talk about a lot on stage is, you know, I mean, not to take anything away from Simon Sinek's otherwise excellent book, but, you know, the idea of starting with why, like the case study that Simon leans on pretty heavily in that book is Apple. And he says Apple started with why. And the truth is we know that's not true because we can see what their marketing campaign was at the very beginning. At the very beginning, it was Apple, a computer for the rest of us. In other words, they started with who? And the rest of us, I mean, it's, you know, it's hard for younger people to comprehend this, but in 1984, the only people who used computers were computer nerds. And I know because I was a computer nerd in 1984. But, you know, his vision was, you know, to democratize technology. And what if we made technology that could work with people who weren't into computers? And that why only makes sense in the context of the who. In other words, his why, democratizing technology, only makes sense to the extent that there were people who didn't have access to it. And I think that's really important. It's one of the things that I think leaders in particular forget, you know, is this idea that oh, my people had no meaning in their lives until I came along with my magnificent organizational purpose. And of course that's not true. People always had their own meaning in their lives. And in fact, there's some great research that Kieran and I found out of the University of Pennsylvania in the States and the University of Bonn in Germany. And what they found was it's actually less important for people to buy into an organization's vision or purpose than it is for the leaders to align that organizational vision and purpose with the vision and purpose of the people, of, you know, that work in the organization. In other words, until you align what's important to you with what's already important to them, you're not in relationship. And people don't need more things to care about. Like if I get up in front of an audience today and I say, how many people here need something new to care about? No one's going to put their hand up because we're all full. However, if you can demonstrate that your organizational purpose aligns with my personal values, supports my personal vision, you know, helps me fulfill my personal purpose, then I'm automatically built, you know, bought in. And I think that's the really critical distinction about, you know, starting with who is it takes you out of egocentricity into centricity around the other. And again, that's a really difficult, you know, Kieran is naturally empathetic. You know, I have to work at it. Kieran is more attuned to other people's needs, much more than I am. You know, and part of my, you know, personal journey and evolution is to be, you know, less egocentric and less judgmental and less about me. And I mean, even if you listen to Kieran's answer to the previous question, a willingness to let go of judgment that purpose should be based on some kind of a social contribution, you know, that's kind of, I think that's a really critical distinction, and not making other people wrong for having a purpose or a vision that's linked to something personal to them.
There are quite a few themes here which I find interesting, you know, regardless of whether we're talking about Maslow's pyramid, which is, you know, the climb up the mountain, it's a linear journey, or even if we look at start with why, again, this is a directional statement that is linear, it sits in the future, that both of these things really do reflect this kind of hierarchical structure in society. And I think it's something that very much has in the past informed our leadership structures as well, which again have been maybe more focused on ego, which you've just spoken about, Dan, and less about the ecosystem. Again, Dan, I was watching your keynotes and you had mentioned meeting, for example, Major General Jim Molan, who literally ran the war in Iraq. And your recollection of meeting him, in my view, really highlighted the differences between hierarchical top-down leadership structures and the more collaborative, human-centric approach required as we move into the future. You guys have very much highlighted today this focus on the we and how we really begin to tap into this. And dare I say, this is something that maybe is more significant in Indigenous thinking than it has been traditionally in the West, is how we create these interconnections. So, Dan, what I'm curious to understand is, I think it's fair to say that we're no, you know, the paradigms, the limitations, to use your language, of business as usual are starting to break down. So how can we better understand what needs to shift in a leadership context in order for us to be able to navigate this, I guess, next economy with a focus on shifting away from the ego and focusing more on the ecosystem as opposed to the ego system?
God, that's a big question. I do think it is a shift from a more hierarchical model of leadership to a more creative model of leadership. One of the interesting things about creative models of leadership is it's very much empowerment based and it's very much collaborative. And one of the things that's interesting in this model is how do you lead people you don't own? And by that I mean, you know, one of the things that Kieran and I have often had to do is to work collaboratively with other, you know, back in our advertising years, work collaboratively with other agencies, with employees who didn't report to us. So, in other words, how do we create engagement with people whose salaries we don't pay? And I think that's a really interesting question. And as life becomes more complicated and the problems we're trying to solve become more complex and interconnected, where we need to have collaboration between organizations, both big and small, between government, between individuals and startups, it requires a kind of leadership that is a bit more, that is more visionary and can engage people, where you're actually looking to create a culture of the willing, a culture of the voluntary, a culture of the enthusiastic. In other words, it's not about, well, I pay your salary, so do as you're told. It's about, no, I've got this vision. There's something in it for you. Let's do this together. And in some ways, it's the nature of Kieran and my relationship. You know, we share the creative director role when we're in advertising. We share the strategic director role when we're in advertising, and we share all of our leadership decisions now. It's very much a partnership, and both of us have our own strengths. And, you know, there are some things that, you know, we will obviously say, well, you take the lead on this, Kieran, or Dan, this is, you know, kind of your bucket. You have a crack at that. However, it does require a greater level of consensus and a willingness to engage each other. I think one of the things about leadership is we tend to think of it as being an influence game that's top down, but I don't think it's just top down. I think it's influence up, down, out, and within. And a lot of that is you know, personal and self leadership. And that's sort of, I think for me personally, that's sort of been the, you know, the personal journey that I've been on for the past few years, is figuring out, you know, how I lead myself better and how I can be better in how I show up in the work that I do.
I mean, that's fundamentally the core of any leadership. It's like, if you can't lead yourself, how can you lead anyone else? So
I don't think that's how we traditionally think about it though, Bex. Yeah. I think a lot of the time we, you know, we do, you know, a lot of leadership is positional authority. Like, a lot of people are really good at their job, but they rise up and they get a management or a leadership role, and they're really good at their job, but they're not really good at leading people. And that's a good thing because, to be honest, it pays Kieran and my salaries. But but it is I think a critical missing piece in a lot of leadership.
So whether we're discussing, I don't know, the yes vote or expressing our opinions in relation to the myriad of global events playing out, thanks to digitization right before our eyes, it is clear that in some ways the world does seem to be becoming a little more polarized. So what I'm curious to understand is, how do we begin to transform these stories of polarity, the you against me or the us against them, or at best stories of tolerance, aka I will put up with you but not really love you? How do we start to shift those stories into stories of acceptance and unity regardless of our difference?
Solve world wars and
well, I'm not suggesting that, but I am curious to understand, how do we create more cohesive stories that bring us together rather than pull us apart?
Well, I think you're right. We are becoming more polarized, and if you think about Eli Pariser's book, The Filter Bubble, the idea that digital media feeds our own opinions back to us. And if it sees we like something, it feeds us more of that. And so what happens is you end up with conservatives getting very conservative news feeds. You end up with liberal progressives getting very liberal progressive news feeds. And very few people are listening to each other. So I think that's actually being amplified. The other thing is if you were a stupid, bigoted person, 50 years ago, well, you were stupid, bigoted person that was sort of isolated in society, but now you can find a community of people who are just like you with a click of a mouse. So I think that's one of the things that's amplifying this. And it's funny, you talked about tolerance. Kieran talks about that a lot on stage, how it's such a terrible word, that it means I don't like you, I don't respect you, but I put up with you because otherwise HR is going to send me on a course. And I think that I think tolerance is a terrible word. And I think the way we talk about diversity is in the corporate world is very surface level and very box ticking. It's like, because typically, when we work with a leadership team, we'll meet the CEO and then we meet a female version of the CEO, a Chinese version of the CEO, a gay version of the CEO, So they're all having the same conversation, just in different accents. And what we've seen from the London School of Business and the Ashridge School of Business in the UK is actually the demographic diversity doesn't move the dial in terms of performance, in terms of problem solving. It's actually cognitive diversity, which we actually do really terribly. And it's where a lot of Kieran and my work is how do we make sure that we have a complete team, a cognitively diverse team? In other words, how do you look to fill your team with people who challenge your point of view, who have different ways of thinking than you do? And that's one of the things that I think we do quite terribly, and we don't like it. Like, it's, I think when Kieran and I...
Not us personally.
Yeah, yes.
No, I mean, but I think corporate teams.
Exactly. But I think when you and I were hiring people, Kieran, we were always conscious of hiring people who annoyed us or irritated us just a little bit, because typically those people are pushing a button that you don't want pressed, and it's useful to have that pressed sometimes.
Diversity by design. We like it.
Diversity by irritation.
Yeah, exactly.
Slightly irritation, not I can't stand being in the room with you, but the more you understand people, the less you actually ever encounter someone like that, and that's what's interesting. We do so much work with
corporations
all over the world, and, we didn't set out to create harmony, but so much of the feedback is the increase in harmony is unbelievable. Like, you've taken these very different styles of people, and through just knowledge and awareness, which is actually what creates less polarization, right? It's empathy, understanding, you know, being able to see more than a linear point of view. It's holding multiple points of view at the same time and going, they can all be true at the same time. Mm. And as the world gets more complicated, that's true. Like, these things are all true from different views. But the more we open people up to accepting that there's more than one perspective, there's more than one tool to solve a problem with, there's more than one frame to filter information through, the more harmony, acceptance, and the less polarization exists. Like, it's almost like when you neutralize a magnet, right? The positive and the negative, the minute you have both those polarities together, you can create a neutral zone.
Hmm. And that's most of the work that Kieran and I are doing now, is around helping people understand people's different filters for making meaning, people's different frames for solving problems, and realizing that actually having someone who thinks differently to you is actually a real asset, rather than something that you should do or you have to do. And even with Kieran and I, you know, the longer we know each other, the more we have an appreciation for our differences. Even though, I mean, it's hard to think back over 30 years, but those things that made us different probably irritated us a little bit in the early days. I mean, I can't even remember if that's true, but it's one of those things where, you know, I'm probably more linear in my thinking and Kieran's sort of more, you know, we don't even talk about linear in that world.
What do you say?
Kieran has thought Tourette's and she jumps around and she's distracted and she'll go from one subject to another. However, I've actually learned to really appreciate that and not be upset by that, and actually to enjoy, you know, Kieran taking us off on a tangent just to see what's at the end of it. And I think that's, you know, that work that we're doing now is actually super important, because it's sort of, you know, as Kieran said, the more you understand people, the more that you understand that most people aren't deliberately trying to be obstructive or deliberately trying to be an a-hole. They're actually just coming from their worldview or from what their filter is. And the more accepting you are of that, the more aware you are of that, the easier your life is. Look, it doesn't stop you being irritated by things from time to time. However, what it does is it gives you an understanding that this person is actually probably well-meaning and isn't deliberately trying to undermine you and ruin your day.
Yeah, it's true. It's interesting, and it shows when you look for it, you see it in multiple fields. I was doing a speaking roadshow with a guy called Professor Sidney Decker, and he's an accident causation safety expert. So his job is to kind of analyze what goes wrong when stuff goes wrong. And he said to me, you know, people often go in looking for a mistake, but I go in and go, well, what went right? And, you know, he says, presume people were trying to do the right thing in their heads, not the wrong thing. Hmm. So why did they climb up the shelf that fell on them? They climbed up because they were trying to get something they needed in a hurry. Or it's like people, we tend to come at people with bad intention and looking for this bad motivation.
I think it comes back to the amygdala you were speaking about before. Yeah. You know, we're primed to look out for the negative, for the risk.
Yeah, have urgent need, must act. Like, you know, when you're driving, you go, did you think? No, they didn't think. Mm. They didn't think, and that's okay. And for us, the more we lean into this acceptance of people, weirdly enough, the more the ability to unlock and change them occurs. They're wrong, we need to fix them.
Yeah.
Well, like, oh no, they're right, we need to understand them. For us, we always say our business is often in the gap between what people say they do and what they actually do. Mm. Because they say this, we call it the behavior gap, right? They say this and they do that. For us, really interesting. And we look to dig in there and we always go, well, what's going on for people in those buckets?
And the truth is that they're not locked. Like, a lot of the work that we do, like a lot of our work is in personality psychology, Rebecca. And if you think about sort of the commercial models of person, whether it's Myers-Briggs or DISC or HBDI, any of those, or if you think about the ocean model, which is the more scientific model, they tend to look at people as if they're fixed. And what Kieran and I have observed and what our research is in actually, no, they're not fixed, but they do have a default, or they do have a dominant. You know, you've got a default way of thinking, a default way of solving problems, and that becomes amplified under stress or duress. And so things like when people are caught in traffic, it becomes amplified. When people are under stress at work, it becomes amplified. And by understanding, A, that other people have a default, and understanding your own default, you're able to become free from it and actually make a real choice and make a real proper decision. You know, no one starts at zero. Mm. There's a great Bill Burr routine, the stand-up comedian, and he's got a temper. He's clearly got a temper. And his wife says to him, he does a joke where he goes, "My wife's always saying to me, 'Oh my God, I don't know how you went from 0 to 10 so quickly. You just exploded.'" And he's like, "I walked in at 6, you know. And I think that's true for all of us. Like, most people, when they're reactive or they're rude or whatever, you don't know what happened to them during the course of the day. You know, they might have a sick child at home, they might have had a fight with this, but whatever it is, right? So you've got all this stuff going on. So very rarely do you meet someone who's in neutral mode.
Mm.
And so I think the more you understand, you know, I think, you know, understanding people frees you from, you know, judgment, but it also frees you from behaving in that default way. It actually gives you choice.
And it frees you from being irritated by them. Like, so much workplace energy is lost to irritation by other people, to wondering what they think about you, why did they do that, are they trying to undermine you, are they trying to get credit. There's so much energy, time, headspace sucked out of corporate genius with this politicking, this, but often self-conversationing. Mm. And the more understanding people have of other people, we see this incredible performance lift in organizations, because that kind of conversation gets taken down so many levels. And you just go, "Oh, they're not coming at me. They're just, you know, they're impatient. They just want to find a solution really quickly because that's what they like doing. They're not angry at me and, you know, pushing, you know, they're not doing this." And it's so useful to understand that, to presume people are trying to behave in a decent way. I mean, look, there's the odd person who, you know, someone didn't hug them as kids, right? And you get the odd person. But on the whole, the societal conversation's been humanity's gotten worse, and I beg to differ. I don't think humanity's gotten worse. I think we've got incredibly better. I think there's much more care and concern. You know, we used to just behave in the most atrocious ways constantly, and it was okay.
Hmm.
I think, and there's a study just been released actually that said human beings aren't less kind than they were so long. There's a really long longitudinal study that said we actually aren't less kind than we were. So again, I think it's just the media makes us feel like that, and then it reinforces our opinion, and then we go, the world's going to, you know, terrible places and people are awful and, you know.
And it moves you from annoyance to amusement, which is actually really a much better place to be. Like if I think about, so Kieran and I for 30 years have had two desks that faced each other, right? And
sorry.
Huh?
You're about to tell them how messy I am.
Only for comic value, Kay. But Kieran's desk is like there's books piled up and magazines and stuff that's been stickers, post-it noted, and she's struggling to find a place to sit and write, right? Whereas my desk looks like a Japanese and Danish designer had a love child. You know, everything is parallel with the sides. There's almost nothing there. It's minimalist, right? And, you know, and Kieran's books are starting to fall onto my side of the table, right?
And you can hear the smug in this as he tells you.
No, it's not smug. It's amusement. but it, you know, I reckon when I was young, that probably would have really annoyed me. But it was just, you know, I just have memories of walking into the office and looking at our two desks and looking at the contrast and just smiling about it. It actually didn't bother me. It was just an appreciation that, you know, Kieran had a different process to me and she needed the stuff around to be visually stimulated and all that kind of stuff. So.
So, look, I think the one thing that we can agree on within the complexity of all of this, all of the nuances, is that words are heavy magic. Words are what bind us. Now, I know you guys have done some incredible work over the last, over the last few decades, but possibly one of your proudest moments is the work you have done with the UN and Singapore government on strategies to reduce human trafficking in the region. Kieran, hearing you talk about this work helped me to understand that even if it's only two words used to describe a team, a situation, or an environment, the impact of that can fundamentally alter how we as humans behave and respond. So I'm wondering, can you share with our listeners your experience of the work that you did with the UN?
Of course, I'm very happy to. And you're right, Rebecca, like language is leverage, we say. And, you know, that old words don't have power. Words have incredible power. And, you know, it's the unconscious acceptance in words. So we were doing some work with the Singapore government and the UN, and they asked us to come in and run a couple of days with them and their people about human trafficking. And there were so many interesting conversations over the couple of days and so many sort of complicated conversations. But one of the things we noticed that we thought was simple and easy to fix was the language. Because they refer to it as Singapore's sex industry, right? And if you think about saying that, Singapore's sex industry kind of sounds legitimate, yeah? I always say, oh, you expect them to have an ABN and create holiday pay, because we use the word industry. And if you think about slavery, again, it's a much more emotional word than human trafficking. So they're saying we have a human trafficking problem. No, you have a slavery problem. But we've diluted the word down. We've lost the meaning out of the words. We've made them more palatable by saying human trafficking. So for us, we said, no, you need to call it slavery and you need to call it organized kidnapping and rape rather than the Singapore, you know, in using the words like industry, because it changes everything and it applies no matter what. We were working with one of the big councils and the same conversation. It's the South Kieran and Dan, people hate paying rates. Like, will you call them rates? What if we simply change the conversation to membership? Because you want to be a member of a community. You want the rubbish collected, the lights turned on. You want parks to take your dogs and kids to. You want all of that stuff, right? You willingly volunteer to be a member of so many things, but you get irritated at rates. So language can unlock a different headspace, and it's a really quick pathway to a different headspace. But in modern world as well, we've actually, like I did a big roadshow for the workplace health and safety, and they call it PPE. I like, you took the word personal protective, whatever, I can't remember what the E is, gear. I can't remember what it is for, but you took it away. You took the words like protection. You took safety out of the conversation. You don't say put your safety gear on. Like, why have you done that? You've probably done it for political reasons, but you've actually sucked the meaning out of the conversation. So for us, putting the meaning back, again, it's just be willing to accept what it is. Someone's probably gone, oh, you know, we don't want to say safety. Yeah, you do. Every morning when you get up, you want to go put your safety hat on so someone doesn't hit you. But for us, language is critical and something we love, encouraging people to use really real language, to stop acronyming and stop trying to sound super smart in the hope people think you are. Just use basic good language that makes people feel something every time you say the word.
I think that's really key, Kieran. It's kind of, we suck the humanity out of our language, particularly in the commercial world. You know, we use corporate language and we forget that we're actually dealing with human beings, not bots. And I think that, you know, now. That's the thing that's really, well, we are working with bots too, yeah. but I think that, you know, being able to put the humanity back into your communication is really critical.
Yeah, you want to make your communication better, make your language more human. It's a super simple thing to do. Sometimes you read stuff and you go, did that actually, I don't even understand what you meant. Mm. I don't know what you said.
So, Dan, can you talk to me about this same subject through the lens of your work with White Ribbon? Because I know you're very passionate about helping men to take more responsibility in relation to the problems with domestic violence.
Look, I think that's a really interesting link, and if sort of marries back to, you know, we talked about starting with who rather than why. I kind of got roped into White Ribbon sort of accidentally. Like quite often I'll be at a conference and I'll be the token bloke on a women's conference panel. For some reason I've ended up as a female friendly speaker. I've had 30 years of training. Yes. Thank you, Kieran. But I think I was at the Sustaining Women in Business conference, which Taryn Hocking ran, and it was in Adelaide. And I don't know, there were 400, 500 women, and there was me and Taryn's husband, Nathan, in the room. And I was on a panel with, like, Holly Ransom, back when Holly was 19. I mean, this is ages ago. She was a kid. But she was a kid but was already extraordinary. And you know, Jane Caro and Angela Katerns. So really, really great women on this panel. And one of the questions I was asked was, to complete the sentence, a woman's place is. And they asked all of us, right? And it was a high degree of difficulty conversation for a man to be in. I was remembering a poster I saw in an advertising textbook when I was 19 years of age at university, and it was a simple but confronting headline. And it said, one in four women will be raped in her lifetime. Will it be your mother, your sister, your daughter, or your wife? And my answer to the question was, well, a woman's place is a man's issue too, because we all have women in our life. And I talked about the fact that, you know, from that moment on, my little sister never had to worry about a ride home, no matter what time of night it was. You know, I still walk here into a car every night after work. And I think the observation I had was, they didn't tell me about why it was important to them. They demonstrated why it would be important to me. And I think that's the you know, when I was talking about the essence of aligning your value with their values, starting with who, is rather than telling people about the importance of your idea and why it matters to you, demonstrate why it matters to them. And I think that's the reason I got involved at the time. It was because it was focused on creating change within male culture in the absence of violence. And I think that to me was, it was a solution-based charity. And a lot of charity, I think, does good work, but a lot of it exists for the sake of existing. Whereas this was, for me, the reason I got involved was it was men talking to men about changing culture. So, yes, women were the beneficiaries of it, but it was actually about changing male culture. And that was, and in other words, it dealt with the causal factor, not the outcome.
People sometimes get annoyed about that, which for us is fascinating. Like, oh, men get really active and concerned when they have daughters. Of course they do. Of course they do. Of course that, you know, when you're a CEO or, you know, you're a leader in a company, you hear stats around women and not getting equity and equality and how they're not getting paid as much and it's not as many in leadership and not many on a board. But imagine having to tell your six-year-old daughter that she's going to be getting treated to your son. She'll have a different options, she'll have less chance of promotion, she'll probably get paid less. Like, all of a sudden, of course people care more, and people can get outraged about that, or they can go, that's just the truth.
Yeah.
And maybe dads are going to be really great allies, and they're going to, because they've got a personally vested interest, they're going to actually do more to agitate for change. Yeah. Maybe that's okay. As Dan said, we have care fatigue. There's so many things we can wake up and care about. Maybe we need the people that are vested to care and change it for the rest of us. Mm. Because we can't all care about everything.
Totally. And it's such an important thing to note in, you know, in an age that has been where we're digitally connected all of the time. Like literally these issues are in our face 24/7. Like where do we even put our attention in all of that?
We can't care. We can't possibly care. If we opened our Facebook today, we can't possibly care about everything that we would be asking us to care about. And we can't say care. Like, yes, I can emotionally go, that's terrible and I'm really sad. But to care enough to do something, to care enough to take action, to care enough to use agency, I can't possibly have enough. So we need the people that have something in it for them to champion it for the rest of us. And it's just a better system. We can't make the whole world care about everything that the world needs to care about. But
I think we should just be grateful that people do good things occasionally. I remember seeing an interview with Robbie Williams once, and he gave $1 million to charity. One of the journalists said, is you giving $1 million to this charity? Isn't that just a publicity stunt? He said, yeah, but when did you last give $1 million to charity?
Good answer.
And it's like, take the win. Why wouldn't you take the win? You know, it's like people say, oh, someone did something and that was virtue signaling. Well, I'd rather people virtue signal than be genuinely an a-hole. It just seems such a, you know, Kieran and I were having this conversation. One of the things that's really interesting is people get really caught up in this concept of fairness. So let's say Kieran and I find $10 and I say to Kieran, okay, Kieran, I'm going to take $9, but I'll give you $1. And Kieran might say, oh, that's unfair. You know, if you're going to do that, I don't want any. And it's like, yeah, but the $1 is, you're still better off with $1 than you were with $0. And we get so caught up in these false economies and these, you know, what, you know, Kieran and I describe as the behavior gap. We make really improper decisions based on emotional responses. And I think that, you know, anyone who does anything that contributes to anyone other than himself should be applauded in what, you know, whatever form that comes.
So let's dive into the world of technology just for a second, into the land of AI, because you guys really are the identity experts. We've spoken a lot about your various perspectives on that. But here we have all of a sudden this technology, AI, which essentially is a mirror reflecting back on humanity, so reflecting back on our identity. Do you think in that reflection, how will that enable us to, I guess, connect more deeply with our identity and start to become more aware of what we need to shift in relation to the intersection between who we are as humans and these emerging technologies?
Well, until it kills us, but sure, even though
Do you know what's funny, Bex? I was speaking at Telstra's Innovation Conference. I was hosting. I did the opening keynote, then I hosted for the day. And there's 3,000 people in the room, and they had Ray Kurzweil, who's the futurist for Google, come out to speak. He wrote The Singularity Is Near, right? Great book. Anyway, I got up and I'm introducing Ray, and I did a bit of a joke. I said, I said, Ray, I really enjoyed the book. To be honest, I didn't finish the book, but I saw the movie, you know, come on, get down on the floor, you know. And, you know, I did a joke about Terminator. And the audience laughed, and then Ray walked up and he said, no, actually, Dan's quite correct. That is, you know, essentially what I'm predicting. And the audience was just, you know, reduced to silence. But we had a really interesting conversation about it, and it's, I think, the greater fear is not that AI will be smarter than us. My greater fear is that AI will be too much of a reflection of us and will inherit or will be, you know, programmed to pick up on our too much on our negative instinct, which is again, as Kieran said earlier, is driven by survival, as opposed to being, you know, driven by our higher angels. And I think that's the one caution I would have around AI is I think you've got people who are developing technology for the sake of developing technology without having a sense of, you know, what the impact will be. You know, Kieran talked about right at the outset about wanting to have a contribution. And I think that's a really good filter to have. You know, how is what I'm creating going to be a contribution? And, we, you know, Kieran and I went and saw Oppenheimer, the movie. And, you know, I know that's a fictionalized version of what really happened. However, you know, what's depicted is him having these reservations and these pangs of conscience, what have I created, you know? And I think, you know, those kind of stories are worth reflecting on in the age we're in.
Hmm. But at the same time, it's exciting that we'll have a mirror back at us. And, you know, it's a question of self-actualization. You know, we circle back and go, well, if all the stuff's done for us, will humanity move forward in other pursuits? If we're safe, fed, you know, if AI can build homes, come and mine, like, if we don't need to work for anything because AI does it all, what do human beings do? We're slightly concerned because we think human beings actually need to be busy and occupied and to have purpose, or things don't exactly go well.
Exactly.
However, it's also the potential to create something wonderful. And I think it's this decision-making. And, again, the more people understand people, the better those decisions can be made.
Hmm.
Because AI is going to mirror us. AI is going to reflect back on us. And it's a really fascinating time to be alive.
Mm, well, I have a feeling people will need the behavior report to get very clear on who they are in the reflection of AI. But as you're saying, Kieran, it is also an opportunity for the technology to reflect the best sides of our nature, and that is an exciting thing. Now, as we come towards the end of the podcast, I have to say I am really excited because I am going to be attending a workshop with you guys in a few weeks, which is all about the core four. Now, obviously, I don't expect you to give away all of the secret sauce, which in reading through some of your testimonials is quote unquote like being able to see through the matrix. Quite a testimonial you have there. I'm wondering if you guys want to give us a brief introduction to what the Core 4 is all about. And, you know, of course, if anyone wants to jump on and follow the behavior report, they might be able to, you know, tune in and see when your next workshop is.
Sounds like a plan. Well, I think there's probably three key distinctions in what we do in the Core 4 versus, you know, other strengths, strategies or personality psychology. And the first is we say it's not fixed, it's fluid. In other words, you have a default or a dominant, but that's not who you are. You know, and, you know, it's not Dan, you're an INTJ and that's all you will ever be. No, you have the ability to evolve beyond that. The second thing I think that's key in this is that we tend to think of our strengths and weaknesses as being polar. You know, in other words, our strengths are good, our weaknesses are bad, only play to your strengths. Now, the problem with that is strengths and weaknesses are usually contextual. They, you know, your weaknesses actually offer the greatest opportunity for performance improvement, and they also tend to amplify our cognitive biases. Like if, you know, you've heard the expression, if all you've got is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. Well, that's great until you've got to change your light bulb. And I think the third difference is the idea that you're one thing and not all things. And I think, you know, Kieran and I are great believers in developing a complete team, but also developing yourself as a complete individual and being open to just because you've developed a particular skill or a particular strength or a particular way of seeing the world, it probably means that you've neglected other aspects of yourself. And those are real opportunities to be more complete as an individual. So how do we build complete teams, but also how do you build yourself as a complete individual?
We think growth and development is actually about understanding, yeah, that you are, you can have all of these frames and positions. You know, you're not an archetype. You're not a personality type. Yes, you have a leaning, you have a tendency, but you might be really different at home than you are at work. You might be different in this social situation than that one because you're a mixture. And for us, with the more we can give people that understanding, A, of where they tend to go as a default, but B, where else they can go, then we unlock all this potential and we unlock this freedom in a way, you know, this freedom to choose who you want to be in that moment. And for us, that's amazing. And, you know, also to teach people that they can read other people, that people give cues and clues all the time to their favorite position from which to view the world. And when you understand that, you can have influence, you can get what you need out of them, you can get their best out of them, even if they're not aware.
Actually, that's another critical distinction is, like, if I need you to do a 5-page multiple choice psychometric test before I can have a conversation, that's not very practical. But as Kieran said, you know, if you learn to look for visual, verbal, you know, behavioral, values-based cues, people reveal how they feel to the world by how they talk. It's just you've got to learn how to listen.
We teach you that language as well. And it's why it's so useful for individuals and teams and companies, because they get to sort of, it turns attention out. I was mentoring a guy, we mentored Darren, and the conversation we were having around his work is the problem is that when you're in a conversation, like there's three of us here now having a conversation, but it's easy for there to be six conversations. Well, actually more than that, because we're each having a conversation with ourselves. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
So, and then we're having a conversation between us all. And the problem is you get into meeting rooms and boardrooms and teams, and the more you add people, imagine you put 20 people in a boardroom, how many conversations are happening? So for us, if we can shut down the internal conversation and we can make people very present in the conversation they're meant to be having, we transform that relationship and that conversation.
Gosh, you've just offered just a big chunk of gold right there. You know, as a podcast host, I hadn't even considered the fact that right now there is six people in the room, and it's absolutely true. It's so true. And I mean, gosh, how just having that awareness can totally transform the way we show up, whether it be here on a podcast or in a meeting. I can't wait. I'm glad I've signed up for this workshop. That's just from a 2-second conversation about it.
Like, we are too.
So my last question for today is simply this. Is there anything that you haven't already shared in today's conversation that you feel is important for our listeners to hear at this exact moment in time?
Look, I think, you know, a lot of the work that we do comes back to, you know, the Socrates quote, know thyself. I don't know why they translate him from Greek into ancient English. It just should be know yourself. But I think that's...
It sounds much more thoughtful.
It does, doesn't it? It has weight. It has gravitas. But I think I would say know thyself, but also know others. And the more interested you are in other people, the easier your life gets to be, I think. And you talked about some of the great testimonials we've had, and we've worked with organizations, and it's transformed teams, it's transformed, you know, it's made them more collaborative, it's improved communication, it's improved leadership and engagement and all that kind of stuff. But the best feedback we get, I think, is oh my God, I now understand what my partner is saying. I thought they were saying A, but they were saying B because our filters are different, etc. Or you've transformed my relationship with my daughter. I thought I was an ineffective parent. I thought I was, you know, just not connecting. And it's just, you know, she has a different filter to me. And it's interesting that, you know, that personal stuff is really gratifying. And, you know, Kieran and I have often laughed about how much her little girl, who's my goddaughter, is like me. Sorry, Kieran, that's a really tough mothering gig. But I, you know, Kieran said, to be honest, I've had 30 plus years of learning how to deal with that personality type. And it's you know, having an understanding of that actually makes it easier. Wouldn't you agree, Kate?
Oh, definitely. 100%. It's an understanding, because with understanding comes power, right? Knowledge is power, and self-knowledge is power. But the other thing for me, you're like, well, you know, I'm very big at the moment. I mentioned it at the front, on redefining time for people. Mm. And, you know, TikTok, I always say, I often say TikTok, not like the platform, but in the reminder that we don't have long. And, you know, people put off this work and they go, oh, I wish I'd done it sooner. And, you know, you've got a child now. You see how quickly time goes. And we have 5 weekends till Christmas, depending when this comes out. And I always say to people, a year isn't a very long time. It's 52 Saturdays. We have 52 Saturdays every year. Mm. That's all we get. And, you know, we need to get moving on this self-knowledge. You don't have time. You know, you have time to know yourself, but the quicker you can know yourself, the more power and agency you have, and you get to make the difference you want to make. You get to then have the joy of going, oh, what's my purpose? And all those wonderful things. You have time to think about it. Otherwise, you blink and you wake up and you go, oops, I wish I'd done more. Mm. I wish I'd been brave. And no one regrets those kind of day-to-day boring things, but they regret not being braver and more asking for more and chasing what they want and facing who they are so they can grow. They don't regret that.
Mm. What a powerful way to end the podcast today. Thank you, guys. Where can our listeners find you? Where can they follow you on Instagram, websites?
They can find us at the behavior, THEBEHIAVIOURRPT for the behavior report. Sorry, it's the Australian spelling, not the American spelling. And report is RPT, or tbr.news is our website.
Dan and Kieran, it has been such a pleasure to have you both on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, as always, for dedicating your time to the DNA of Purpose podcast. As we conclude today's episode, I invite you to extend the conversation online. Feel free to reach out via LinkedIn or follow along at Rebecca Maklad, that is MAKLAD, on Instagram, where we're crafting a tapestry of stories, reflections, tools, and insights to empower your purpose-driven leadership strategy. I love feedback, and we always welcome guest suggestions. Should today's episode ignite a spark within you, reviews really do help us to continue to attract the world's most prominent purpose-driven leaders as our guests. And if you know somebody who would benefit from one of our episodes, then share that story with abundance. A big thanks to Supernova Tribe, who produce this podcast with style, and Guide Your Light, a network for podcasts with purpose.